Welcome to Inside Education. We're online at insideed.com. I'm Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. Coming up on this week's programme.
In any piece of text, there's a wonderful world of vocabulary that can bring us in any direction away from the particular context that's there. And that may be the missing link, I think, that I'm referring to.
On this week's programme, we'll consider the words we use when speaking, writing, listening and reading. We'll find out how we learn words and why vocabulary is a sometimes neglected part of developing literacy. But first, an ish chacht an arig beg an law igdal conchina. Barry Hennessy has been pondering the month beloved of Raftery on Filla.
Hello again, Sean. Well, what does February mean to you? St. Bridget's Day, probably, if you're a primary teacher. Maybe even a romantic night in or out for Valentine's Day. But in secondary schools, more often than not, February means mock exams. These days, three companies provide the lion's share of mock exam papers sat in Irish schools. They are DEB Exams, Mocks.ie and Examcraft. These companies not only provide the examination papers, they also offer an optional correction service as well. It can be a costly time for parents who often have to cough up €100 or more per child. But do mock exams really serve a useful purpose? Philip O'Callaghan is the managing director of Examcraft.
I certainly feel they do, and it was, if you want to achieve mastery in anything, whether it be performing arts or whether it be sport or indeed whether it be mock exams, I mean, there are two things you must do, and that is you must have focused practice, and you must get feedback and adjust your practice based on that feedback. And I feel that the mock exams provide very valuable feedback to students and indeed teachers about how the students are performing. And I suppose if we step back from it, we all know that the exams the students are about to take in June are really important to them. So I think it's reasonable that the young people will be given an opportunity to sit an exam which would mirror the exam they'll be taking in June.
You mentioned the feedback. Sorry to interrupt you, Philip. You mentioned the feedback there. Do your correctors, as a matter of routine, provide detailed feedback to the individual students and to the class teachers?
The feedback is provided. Well, I suppose there are various levels of feedback. Obviously, each exam script is corrected in accordance with our particular marking scheme. And then the student can obviously see exactly where they have lost particular marks. So if a question has three sections, each section will be marked out of the allocated marks, and students can see where they have lost marks. And then there's a more general report provided to the teacher indicating where students in the class may have had difficulty or areas they may focus on between now and June.
Yeah, let's just talk about the processes now. You've already mentioned the word marking schemes there, because this is something that I'm particularly interested in. I mean, how do you go about ensuring that the papers that you provide, the exam papers, are similar in level to what the students will be getting in June? You know, what expertise can you draw on, given that the internal processes of the State Exams Commission are pretty secret?
Yeah. Well, so the very first thing I would say, Barry, is that we take the setting of the papers very, very, very seriously, because we know that what the students are playing for is a very, very serious game. And when we start at the end of one mock exam cycle, preparing for the next. And we engage the most experienced teachers. Many of them will be SEC examiners. Many of them will be authors of textbooks to set those papers. This was the most important thing. They're all teaching professionals with significant experience, subject matter experts, and they have an intimate knowledge of the exam requirements. They're the people that we have setting our papers. And then it goes through a process of from setter to teachers who proof the papers, and it's an iterative process before we come to a final paper, maybe 4 or 5 months after initially engaging a setter.
Philip, there is perhaps one difference that I need to put to you, which is that during the State Exams Commission's marking, there is an ongoing process of review of the marking scheme where if you have a particular question on which the marks candidates are getting are not up to expectations and that the score relative to the previous year is being thrown out of kilter, as it were, yeah, the marking scheme will be adapted. And one gets the impression that the mock exams companies don't do that.
That will be correct. I think if you understand the difference in the cycle as well, schools expect that the mock exam papers are returned to them corrected within about 3 weeks. The SEC will have their papers in June, and they'll be working at them full-time until the middle of August. And indeed, it's supposed, it is a mock exam, so I would presume that the overall marks in the mock exams will be somewhat lower than they would be in the state exams anyway.
Philip O'Callaghan, Managing Director of Examcraft there. But what of the role of teachers who effectively serve as agents of companies like Examcraft? The Teachers Union of Ireland has been to the fore in highlighting the impact of the economic crisis on students in disadvantaged schools. Would it not be possible then for teachers to set their own mocks and remove one major burden on hard-pressed parents? Annette Dolan is the TUI's Deputy General Secretary.
The pressure is really there from the students and the parents themselves, who want an outside independent evaluation. They want another teacher to see their work, to give external feedback, and they want it to be as near as possible to the conditions under which they undergo the Leaving Cert. I mean, talking to teachers in our own sector, that would be teachers teaching in community and comprehensive schools and in vocational schools, that's the sector in which we have members, would say that they, in a lot of their schools now, they've actually moved to doing their own kind of mock exams at junior cert level and correcting them themselves. But there is still kind of a view among parents and students that they would like students to do an external mock exam at Leaving Cert.
Yeah, you mentioned, of course, that TUI members are traditionally drawn from schools which would often regard themselves, or be regarded, I suppose, officially as fairly disadvantaged. In general, do schools pass on the full cost of the mocks to their students, or do they tend to absorb some of it?
Yes, from speaking to our own members, they, you know, have advised me that provision is made for students who generally can't afford to pay.
TUI's Annette Dolan there, and I should add, to be completely fair, that Inside Education is aware of a whole range of measures schools take to address the burden of mock exams. Some fee-paying schools simply include them in their annual fees, as opposed to levying a messy upfront charge, whilst in the state sector there are disadvantaged schools that pay for their students' mocks from the range of financial support they receive from government and other sources. Sean.
Thanks for that, Barry. And Barry will be back with another feature on next week's programme. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programmes can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website, insideed.com. Words are so much a part of our lives that we can easily take them for granted. When we speak, write, read and listen to language, we are using words to convey messages, ideas, desires and emotions. But my guest this week believes that words or vocabulary could be a missing link in our school curriculum. Jean Meegan is a principal lecturer at the Merino Institute of Education, and last week he delivered a workshop to principals at the annual conference of the Irish Primary Principals Network. His talk was about teaching vocabulary as part of an effective literacy programme. In it, he drew on his experience as a learning support teacher for several years in Darndale and on his experience as a teacher educator. Jean was a member of the project team on implementation issues related to child literacy and social inclusion, which was established by the National Economic and Social Forum. We'll hear later why Jean Meegan thinks that vocabulary is the missing link in our push to raise literacy, but first I asked him why we need to pay attention to vocabulary in order to improve standards of literacy.
Well, I suppose before we even address the question of why we pay attention to vocabulary, Sean, we may be well served to actually interrogate what literacy means. And the definition of literacy, from my point of view, is looking at listening and speaking in an oral communication, and obviously vocabulary is a huge part to play there, but also in reading and writing. And indeed, I suppose in our modern world, media literacy comes in there as well. But if I think of the reading part and the writing part, this is where I think that vocabulary has a huge role to play that's not always recognised. In other words, if a child is going to, or indeed an adult is going to write something, they're going to draw on their well of vocabulary. And indeed, if we look at reading and breaking up reading into its constituent parts, we're well aware of the elements like phonics and phonological awareness and how to read words and break up words, decoding you might call it. And we're very aware that children need to be fluent in their reading. But they also need to understand something. And one of the crucial elements of understanding and comprehension is actually vocabulary.
So if we start off then with young children, and how do they go about learning and building the vocabulary that they need?
Well, there, I suppose when you look at the vocabulary for young children come to school with quite a good few words in their own armoury before they ever start, we say, learning to read. And that comes from their listening vocabulary. So developing young children's vocabulary, first of all, you start with their listening vocabulary, which is a huge influence on their speaking vocabulary.
When you say their listening vocabulary, what exactly does that mean?
Those words that they're actually surrounded by and that they hear, right? So in other words, very young children, they're preconditioned to speak, to listen. They're not preconditioned to read, funny enough, or to write. That has only come to us as humans in the last couple of thousand years. But we've all been preconditioned to listen and to speak. So if you want to develop children's vocabulary, the first thing is if you can imagine pouring in that element of the listening vocabulary first, which is going to ultimately have a huge immediate effect on their speaking vocabulary. They won't speak unless they listen. And then subsequent to that, of course, that will have an influence on their reading and their writing. And just on that, if you think of a young child coming to school, their speaking and their listening vocabulary far outstrips their reading vocabulary because they can't read. But that starts to balance out once they start to decode. So after a while, in the early years of school, they get strategies through phonics and sight vocabulary to read words. And then they're coming to a situation where they catch up with their oral vocabulary, so they can actually almost decode anything and read anything. And very often we've come across we hear the third class slump, maybe, where they seem to plateau. And very often the reason for plateauing is that they don't actually keep developing their vocabulary, so they will actually, when they come across new words, they will have it in their vernacular when they come to read it.
I want to come back in a moment to how they learn words as they go up through the school and how they build their vocabulary. But first of all, you mentioned there the importance of children coming to school with certain words and with certain vocabulary. But not all children come to school with the same number of words.
Oh my God, that's so true. And obviously this can be very much rooted in the home background the children might be coming from and indeed the socioeconomic background. There's a very interesting study done by Hart and Risley in 1995 in America, which is astounding, where they looked at privileged families, as they called them, and maybe families from lesser socioeconomic backgrounds. And astoundingly, as they've tracked these many, many children over many, many studies across America, they found that as many as 30 million words can be heard, more words can be heard by a privileged family by the age of 3 than an underprivileged family. Now, 30 million words, what an impact that would have on listening vocabulary. Now, that's not 30 million different words. That means being in the milieu of language, if you like, and listening to words. So that's where it can happen. So that can be dramatic before children ever. So it's not a level playing pitch when children enter school. Hence, an awful lot of our attention in, we'd say, in areas of disadvantage can be actually to focus on children's vocabulary. Not just, very often we say oral language, but let's look at what that means. It means maybe their listening vocabulary and their speaking vocabulary as well.
Okay, so as we go up to school then, and you mentioned the third class slump, what do teachers need to do at that stage to deliberately teach vocabulary, or does the explicit teaching of vocabulary stop at any stage?
Not only does it not stop, I think it needs to actually be, not only does it not stop, but keep going right up through the school. In fact, if you think of the skills of learning to read, for instance, there are some things that are constrained and they actually have a finite life, if you like. We're not always learning the names of letters and we're not always learning the sounds of letters. In fact, that's an endeavour that you'd expect to see in junior classes. Children are not always learning how to articulate themselves and the syntax, the order of words as they happen in sentences. But things like comprehension and the vocabulary we use, and indeed our spelling and how we write, these are lifelong endeavours, and you or I, Sean, have not finish learning our vocabulary, as we well know. So it is very, very important that we have a system of teaching vocabulary that actually endures for life. And one of the things that I would say is that if you have a program for teaching vocabulary that can endure right throughout the school, it will be valuable. And I would include in that areas things like teaching individual words, very important. Also looking at wide reading that will inform your vocabulary, looking at fostering an awareness and a word consciousness, you know, having fun with words is very, and then teaching word learning strategies. So I see all those as being the answer to your question as regards what happens right throughout the primary school.
And if we take just one of those word learning strategies, what kind of things can teachers do to help children learn words?
Again, they're probably endless, but there's some very, very interesting word learning strategies. If you think a word in itself never sits on its own, so if you take any word that you can think of, there's possibilities it has got a synonym, another meaning that's very similar. Its possibilities has got an opposite, an antonym, and that's also extending the meaning of it. But you can also look, if we say, looking at a word and actually getting a deep processing of it. If you take a word such as, we say, fast. Oh, I was fast asleep last night. So that means I was sound asleep. But for the child, even though they can decode, that's a very simple word to decode, like, because it's regular. There's many, many other meanings that you can extend. So the deep processing might say, oh God, I drove very fast down the street in my car. I kept a fast hold on the bar when I was doing the hang gliding. My watch is running fast at the moment. And actually, I've had to fast for the last 2 days because I have to go for an operation. 2 days might be a bit excessive, but you know what I mean. So in other words, there you have, we'll say, an idea of looking at multiple meanings of words. Now, not every word has multiple meanings. If you take other words, other strategy can be used is obviously, if I come across a word and I want to learn it, sometimes there's recourse to look at a dictionary. Right, and that can be very valuable also for young children to go and get a definitional approach, or indeed to look at the context in which it occurs. But there's also, I suppose, a caveat there. It can be dangerous to look at dictionaries only. I think there's a well-known story about the child who looks up the word extinguish, and it says to put out, and then writes the sentence, my mom extinguishes the cat every night. So you can see how a definitional approach alone mightn't be good. So one book I would recommend would be the Collins Cobild New Student's Dictionary, which gives very student-friendly definitions. So if, for instance, if I was looking up the word furious, I'd say things, you'd read in that dictionary something like, I'm furious if I'm very angry at something. So in other words, it's a very student-friendly definition, and it usually puts it in context as well then by putting it into a sentence. So you can see how that might be different. Lexicographers are bound by space, so they're very often very concise meanings. And of course, as I said, as you saw from the cat being extinguished, they can often have multiple meanings that are not explicit for the child.
And I'm judging that from the context that lexicographer is someone who writes a dictionary.
That's right. The person who is, exactly.
What are the benefits of developing a wide vocabulary in order to improve literacy?
Well, I suppose one of the major benefits of developing a wide vocabulary to improve literacy is associated with comprehension, right? There is a level of, for young children having vocabulary, is that they need it because when they read a word, they need to get affirmation that what they've said is correct. So they're struggling through or around, they're decoding it. If it's in their word bank, oh, yes, that's the word, and they get confirmation and they will say the word. So that's at one level. But the real value that we get from developing vocabulary comes in the, I suppose, a lifelong endeavour of comprehension. That if I'm actually reading a piece of text, or reading anything, or even listening to a text, is that the vocabulary is the elements that are going to be most important to aid my comprehension of it. Understand that I'm putting the caveat in there, just because I understand all the words doesn't mean I understand the piece, because there's also a contextual part to that. But typically, if I'm going to comprehend, vocabulary is a great indicator for that, knowledge of vocabulary.
That's very interesting about the fact that you might understand the individual words but not necessarily understand the part. Could you say a little bit more about that, because comprehension is so important in literacy?
Well, the context, I suppose, that you're talking about is in other words, I may know how to decode words and understand words. But for instance, if I came along and I think of words now like crease, and wicket and overs. I can read those words and I understand what a crease might be. But if, in the context of cricket, which I don't know much about, I might be really at sea if I was reading a piece, understanding all the individual words, but not necessarily understanding the context, because I'm actually not au fait with that particular context of cricket. Similarly, if I was playing a golf, and there's many, many terminologies involved there, so I can read bogey and birdie and eagle. We know what an eagle is, but in golf is a particular sense. I might be struggling, right? Because I won't know the context. So the context is a huge indicator as well of our ability to understand something, not just the vocabulary that is actually inside in the piece of text.
You refer to vocabulary as the missing link in reading and language instruction in Ireland. Why is it the missing link? And what makes you say that it is?
There's two elements why I actually refer to vocabulary as the potential missing link, because it's depending on where we actually look at for the links in the chain. If we look for the chain within our Irish curriculum, for instance, there is not as much attention paid to reading vocabulary in the curriculum as I would like. There is references to vocabulary within our oral language curriculum, and indeed there's references to vocabulary in the context of sight vocabulary in the reading curriculum. In other words, we're talking about, can you recognise a word in sight? But what we don't have is explicit indicators set out that we need to teach individual word learning strategies, that we need to foster an awareness of words, that we need to teach individual words, and maybe exemplars how to do that. So I think that might be the one part of the missing link. The other part of the missing link is that I think the focus, a huge focus, and it's a welcome focus we have on getting children reading in this country. So the focus can be very often on those elements, those constrained elements I referred to earlier, looking at things like phonics and phonological awareness. And sometimes the child, it seems to be, we can get the child to that decoding level, but there's a next level, I will say, that is limitless, of teaching the vocabulary skills that will aid comprehension. And I think that's where the missing link might be, is that we actually focus very, very heavily on decoding. And then we go to very often comprehension that is actually at a literal level. So we're asking questions, giving answers. But in any piece of text, there's a wonderful world of vocabulary that can bring us in any direction, away from the particular context that's there. And that may be the missing link, I think, that I'm referring to.
And I suppose one of the things we associate with teachers of previous generations is that they would have been very good in talking about the Latin roots of words and the Greek roots of words, and that doesn't seem to happen much anymore. Was that something that was valuable in terms of developing vocabulary?
I think it was invaluable, the attention. And I think if you look at, I didn't refer to it there so far, but if you look at teaching individual words, one of the most powerful thing is look at root words, look at prefixes and suffixes. And you mentioned the Greek and the Latin origins. So if I actually say a word like subalpine, I might know what it means, but sub means probably telling me it's below something. If a word like intervocalic, a very obscure word, but inter telling me it's between. So that actually means between vowels. So if I see a consonant between two vowels, that you could call that intervocalic. I'm taking those examples because they're so obscure, we would never know what they mean, maybe, except in a very specific domain, but yet we've clues related to them. Supernumerary, like we know super is above and beyond. So those root words and those Latin and Greek origins do help us in relation to actually learning new words. And it should be something that I would regret if that was a part of that would leave our curriculum, because I think it will always serve us well.
And if a school, Gene, decided to concentrate on developing children's vocabulary over a period of time and, you know, put a lot of effort into it, say, for a school year, how could they tell at the end of that time if they had been successful?
That's a very interesting question, because outside of looking at, we say, standardized tests to see are they successful by doing your vocabulary tests, I think the indicators here go to a broader aspect of how important vocabulary will be in life, the confidence they will have, their ability to express themselves, their self-esteem, their ability to develop relationships with each other can often be based on the vocabulary. If you want to look at standardized looking at testing, if, for instance, tests that are frequently used in schools like the MICRA-T, huge amount of the testing of children's reading is around comprehension, and specifically as it happens around closed procedure, where you're taking a word out of text and there's a gap in the text, and really they have to draw on their knowledge of vocabulary to supply a word. If you want to bring it outside of school and in life in general, Sean, if you think of it and you're going for a job in the morning, frequently, one of the deciding factors is your ability to present yourself orally in front of another group of people. And vocabulary is one of your mainstays for doing that successfully.
Jean, when you presented at the IPPN conference, you had over 200 teachers listening to your ideas. If I was to look into their classrooms today, and if they had taken seriously what you had said about vocabulary, what would I see in those classrooms?
Well, it's an interesting question again. I would hope someone was listening. I would hope, first of all, from the response I got, I'm no way worried about the Irish teachers and how they're teaching. But I think what they need, the message I was getting mostly, is that we have some sort of a structure for doing this. There's a great appetite for teaching vocabulary. I would like, for instance, that these teachers were actually taking some of the structure on, is that we'd have things like the word of the week or a word wall. And that would there be a word jar, and all these things are actually focusing on looking at individual words and encouraging children to use vocabulary and become aware of it. I got feedback from a principal who was at the conference actually and at my talk, and they were actually taken by a strategy called for learning words that is actually associated with how children learn syllabification, or how many syllables are in a word, and rhyme. So, for instance, it's called a hink pink in the literature. The hink pink, so hink and pink rhyme, and they're one syllable each. So then you give clues to children, like, you know, oh, this boy was very happy. So then a boy that was very happy, it could be a glad lad, right? Or if he wasn't happy, he'd be a sad lad, but it would fit into the structure of hink and pink. And you can actually, children like making up the clues for that, and they love actually trying to find the answers for those. If you wanted to bring that on, by the way, for two syllables, it's hinky pinky, and for three syllables, it's hinkity pinkity. So you can see there's a level there. So, for instance, for a clue for hinky pinky, you might be saying, "Oh, these two words describe an improved symbol of the alphabet." If you think about that, what would that be? Well, the alphabet, a better letter. So you can see. So there's an example, and I'd like to see some games and strategies that has been infused into the classroom, because these can be used throughout the day. I do remember reading a book by Brian McMahon, The Master, where he actually describes smuggling vocabulary and smuggling words into the classroom, whereby in the middle of maybe a maths or an SESE lesson, he could stop, go in behind the old easel blackboard he'd have, and write some words in a little journal that he had, and then reappear, much to the amazement of the children. "What were you doing, Master?" "Oh, I can't tell you. I can't tell you what I was doing. It's something very important. I'm collecting words," and go on with his lesson. And then he might refer back again in the middle of the visual arts lesson later on that day. He'd say, "Oh, sorry, I have to stop for a second. Go in again, retreat, and write down some more words." And he reported in that book that after a while, he could see young children, first of all, asking, could they do it? And he assured them they couldn't, because it was much too serious an endeavour for young children. And after a few days, he would see little red notebooks appearing in bags where they were actually privately collecting words as well. And I would like to see our teachers becoming logophiles and actually hoping that all their children will become logophiles as well.
And what's a logophile?
A lover of words.
And that was Jean Meegan from the Merino Institute of Education. That's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on InsideEd.com or on iTunes. You can email us at InsideEducation@DublinCityFM.ie. Thanks to my guest, Jean Meegan, and to my colleague, Barry Hennessy. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.